Well, first of all, explain what you did. You had a huge set of data about people's web searches, and then how did you use it?
So we were interested in understanding how the sexual brain works, and we're computational neuroscientists, which means we try to figure out how the software of the brain works. And to do that, we usually start out by trying to find some large behavioral data set that we can use to model how the brain works. So in the case of sex, we realized that there's this enormous volume of data about sexual behavior that's right in front of us on the internet. So we tried to gather as much different kinds of online data as we could related to sexual behavior. So some obvious examples are searches for sexual material, and we also looked at websites, the popularity of websites, traffic to different websites.
Are you basically talking about porn sites?
Mostly for men, it's porn sites. When we started out, we didn't quite know what to look for. Porn was an obvious choice, but it turned out that women are actually more interested in reading about erotic material. So we downloaded a million erotic stories, many of which were written by women for women. In particular, they belong to a genre of material called fan fiction. So these are stories written by amateur authors, almost entirely women, romantic and erotic stories about different characters from popular culture, from popular movies and TV shows. For example, some of the most popular fan fiction is from Harry Potter and from the Twilight series. And so
these are people who would actually create new stories using some of the same characters we're familiar with, let's say, from Twilight, but creating whole new storylines.
Exactly right. And so they would have imagined different endings than was in the actual book or in the movie. For example, they might imagine that at the end of Lord of the Rings that Gollum, gets to keep the One Ring. But most of fan fiction is romantic pairings. They take characters in the stories that didn't actually hook up in the story and have them hook up. Or maybe they did hook up, but they have them they tell the story in a more sexual and erotic way. For example, 50 Shades of Grey, it actually started out as Twilight fan fiction. It was a fan fiction story about Edward and Bella that then just got developed into a much more elaborate story with different characters. But a lot of erotic material starts out as fan fiction these days.
Hmm. So you were pouring through all of this data out there. I mean, the thing that's astonishing reading about your research is, I mean, we're talking millions of searches, web searches that you looked at, millions of websites. I mean, it's sort of the amount of material you were collecting was astounding.
It truly was enormous. And until we did our research, the only systematic scientific analysis of people's sexual desires was Kinsey back in the 50s, I mean, half a century ago. And he looked at around 15,000 people's sexual interests, mostly middle-class white people in the Northeast. And now with our data, we could look, like you said, we looked at what the sexual behaviors online of truly hundreds of millions of people. We looked at more than a billion web searches. And we looked at the million most popular websites. Like I said, a million erotic stories. We even got 10,000 digitized romance novels that we analyzed. Millions of search histories of individual people's search patterns.
So when you say, when you're talking about search histories, you're talking about what words they enter into. Basically, what turns them on by looking at the particular words they're looking for.
That's right. And words and phrases, and sometimes people even type out very elaborate descriptions of what they're looking for. It's not just busty women. It might be busty Asian women who are having sex with sailors in China. It's extremely, sometimes a little shockingly specific. But that's exactly what we were interested in finding out, is these kinds of details and how frequent different interests appeared, how the different patterns in the broad patterns and the way people frame their searches for sexual material. We looked at everything. And
I have to say, I didn't know all of this data was available to to someone like you to come and mine and to analyze.
Oh, we live in a world with little privacy. So our data was almost entirely anonymous. That was, we didn't know the individual who was making searches for the most part. We certainly didn't try. We made no effort to identify individuals, but you know, we leave digital footprints whenever we're online these days, and there's always groups out there trying to gather that up. You know, that's just part of living our new online life.
And I suppose that one of the great advantages you have over, let's say, what Kinsey did all those decades ago is you were not doing, you're not basing your results on interviews. In other words, you know, people might not be that honest about what their real sexual desires are.
This was really the first time scientists could see what people were truly and really interested in. Because as you pointed out, Kinsey, it was a survey. It was a self-report survey. People chose what to say. And of course, people are very willing to delude a researcher, and they delude themselves sometimes too. You know, sometimes we may not even be honest with ourselves with what we're actually liking. But with the web data, it's what people actually did, what they searched for, what they spent money on, you know, where they visited day after day after day. So it was, you know, while they were in the privacy of their home. So it's data that shows exactly what people were interested in, and when, and how often, and how much. So it just completely new data, completely new insights. And that's why we found things that were very, very surprising. And they were surprising because just nobody really knew what do men and women actually like, you know, on a broad scale. We just didn't know that.
So what were some of the surprises?
So different surprises for men and for women and different kinds of surprises. Some of the surprises for men was the age of women that men were looking for. Now, no surprise, the most common age range that guys are looking for is young women, teens, college age, definitely the most popular kind of erotic material for men. No surprise there. But what surprised us was the popularity of older women, women in their 40s, women in their 50s, even in their 60s, all have very sizable fan bases among men. I think there's about women over the age of 40 is about one-third as popular as teen and young women. And that may seem like a fraction, but really, if you think about that, you know, when you think about porn, when you think about what guys are looking at for sexual arousal, the fact that it's only three times as much that young women as middle-aged women, it's a bit surprising. And, you know, one particular genre that we found to be far more popular than anybody predicted was something called granny porn, which is just like it sounds, and has a fan base all around the world. Every country we looked at has some segment interested in that. And it's something that nobody predicted that would be found to be sexually arousing. And yet there it was in every country. It does seem to be something that's very real and out there that nobody had expected to find. Another surprise was body size. So body size, body shape, very important for the male sexual brain. And everybody seemed to predict that what men like the best is, you know, very skinny women. And to our surprise, it turns out most popular is average body size. That is the case. But heavy women turn out to be very, very popular, far more popular than anybody expected. In fact, there was three times as many searches for fat girls as there is for skinny girls. There's actually very few websites devoted specifically to skinny girls, but websites devoted to heavy girls, they're called BBW for big, beautiful women. Extremely popular, again, in every country that we looked at, not just America and Europe, but everywhere.
That's interesting, because I would have guessed that there might be some cultural variations there, that in some countries they might value bigger women, in other countries, thinner women.
Definitely you see some cultural variation on exactly what the best, the optimal sexual body type is. But again, in every country, in every single country, heavy women were more popular than skinny women, or specifically heavier than average women were more popular than skinnier than average women. Average women always most popular everywhere we looked. But
And yet, we've always heard that there is kind of this ideal from a heterosexual male perspective, sort of this ideal female body shape, you know, the large bust, the slender waist and so on. Are you saying that's not necessarily the case?
So interesting, when the heavy women that are that do appear in the erotic material, they also have proportions that are similar to sort of this the stereotype idea of a woman with, as you said, busty with a small waist. So usually the heavy women that are popular have extremely large breasts, and they still have curves. So they're very curvy heavy women. So in a sense, it's kind of like it's like a supersized representation of the ideal woman.
Now, the other thing that I found interesting is getting at this difference between what men and women look for is apparently men are really turned on just by what a woman looks like. Visual cues. I mean, it just boom, you know, it just triggers sexual desire, whereas apparently that does not work at all for women.
That's right. So that's a fundamental difference between the male sexual brain and the female sexual brain. Male sexual brain definitely wired to be very aroused by the sight of things. And many, many websites devoted to one specific visual cue. For example, breasts. You know, there's websites where you go and they're pictures, just pictures of breasts and nothing else. You know, if you really think about it, it's just a very strange sort of thing. It's just page after page of close-ups of breasts. There's even a few websites devoted to nipples. Just there's men who have strong sexual interest just in nipples, and you can just go page after page of nipples. So there's no women that are looking at page after page of a man's buttocks or a man's chest. There's just doesn't exist. And you know, women don't make lists of the top 10 male packages. but there's plenty, you know, every man seems to put up his own list of, oh, here's the top five chests that I enjoy.
So when you compare, say, straight men and gay men, similarities, differences, other than just, you know, whether they're looking for men or women?
Comparing straight men to gay men's sexual taste, that was one of the biggest surprises from our data. We didn't really know what to find. I'm a heterosexual male, so I didn't look at any gay pornography until I started this research, and I really had no idea what to expect. I think I vaguely imagined that there would be probably some feminine elements to it. I just didn't know. I was curious. And so we gathered, you know, millions and millions of examples. We watched, you know, thousands of examples of gay porn and analyzed millions of gay men's searches and looked at tens of thousands of gay porn websites. And it turns out gay porn is identical to straight male porn. It's absolutely indistinguishable. The only difference is that it's the man that's the center of attention rather than the woman. But the things, the body parts that gay men search for, it's the same four body parts that straight men search for. So in every country in the world we looked at, straight men search for four body parts. It's breasts, butts, feet, and then the real surprising one is penises. Hmm. Penis is extraordinarily popular.
Really? Four straight men?
That's right. Yes. Penis is it's harder if you have the data. Men search for penises pretty much just as often as they search for vaginas in sexual searches. And there's tons of websites devoted to large penises. So it's not that a guy wants to exclusively look at penis. I mean, there's not websites where he's looking at page after page of penis. He just wants there to be a large penis in the picture. They want pornography where a large penis is featured prominently. They want the woman to be there too, but it seems to be, you know, very sexually arousing to have the penis there. And there's some good reasons for that, which I can get to in a moment. But these four body parts, chests, buttocks, feet, and penis, same four body parts that gay men search for. You know, gay men also have foot fetishes. They search for chests, they search for butts, and they search for penises even more than straight men do. But the similarity between the search patterns for these four body parts is almost identical between gay men and straight men.
Well, and then the other thing that I found interesting is women don't seem especially interested in looking for penises at all.
Not at all.
Is like something far more
men
interesting.
Men are way
to men.
More interested in penises than women are. I mean, we analyzed the body parts in romance novels, including erotic romance novels, and the penis is not even in the top 50 body parts that are mentioned. And when they are described, it's funny reading women's descriptions of penises in erotic stories and romance novels. You can tell it's nothing a man would write. One thing that's often appears is an emphasis on blood. The penis was engorged with blood. Blood flowed. Blood was pulsing. You know, when men think about the penis, they don't want anything to do with the blood. They don't connect blood with the penis. So it's just a very different idea of the penis. But
how do you explain that scientifically? I mean, why this male obsession with the penis?
So there's two probable explanations, both having to do with evolutionary biology. So what I find to be the most persuasive explanation of this is something called the sperm competition cue. So sperm competition cues are felt throughout the animal kingdom. And basically the way these work, it's for when males are competing with other males to reproduce with the female, A sperm competition cue is a way of helping him sexually compete. And what it, the way it works is, if a male sees a female having sex with another male, he immediately realizes, oh, if I want to have a hope of impregnating her, of reproducing with her, I better go after her with even more sexual arousal. I must be more forceful in the copulation. I must be more aroused. I must, frankly, ejaculate more. One example of a sperm competition cue is in the chimpanzee. The chimpanzee has very, very large testicles, the largest testicle ratio of any ratio of testicle size to body size of any creature. And the reason is for sperm competition, because they are very promiscuous, so they're constantly having sex with females after another male has. So to compete, they have to ejaculate more sperm. So in humans, we actually have a sperm competition, a physical sperm competition adaptation ourselves. It's the shape of the penis. A male penis is shaped like a shovel, and it's actually designed to shovel out other man's sperm. If you having sex after somebody else, it's designed to get rid of anything that might still be in there. In fact, this is why men get flaccid after they ejaculate. You know, if you've ever wondered, you know, why do men become flaccid when they're finished up? It's so they don't accidentally shovel out their own sperm. It's so it will stay in there. So a sperm competition cue, we see this throughout the animal kingdom. We see it in primates, and there's no reason to believe it's not going to exist in the human male too. So the way it would work is, if you see another man around a female or see signs of recent sex, like an erection, then it's going to be more likely to turn you on. And another piece of evidence for this is one of the most popular kinds of erotica in every country we looked at is cheating wives and cheating girlfriends. It's super popular, one of the four or five most popular genres of erotica in every country we looked at. And so you might ask, why are videos and stories about women cheating on their husbands or girlfriends cheating on their boyfriends, why in the world are those so popular? It's probably the sperm competition cue. And so the sight of the penis may be linked to that. It may be linked to the sperm competition cue. I've heard some biologists suggest that, and I find that very persuasive.
Hmm. So we've been talking about male desire. Female desire. You found that just those straightforward visual cues really don't do it for most women.
Now, most women prefer story. Now, let me say that definitely there are some women that enjoy visual pornography. It seems to be about 1 in 3 women do enjoy pornography based on the data that we've gathered. And interestingly, the women that do like visual pornography, we can say a few correlations. Women who like visual pornography, they tend to be risk takers. They tend to enjoy switching roles in the bedroom, sometimes being submissive, sometimes being dominant. They tend to be more socially aggressive. So interestingly, you know, it's not clear what's going on here, but women who like pornography, they tend to behave in other ways that are stereotypically male as well. So certainly that would lead to the hypothesis that perhaps there's some sort of hormonal thing happening that makes these women's brains behave a little more male across the board, not just in terms of liking pornography.
Now, one point of clarification, my understanding is your research was mainly just on heterosexual women, right? You actually found some resistance studying lesbian women?
That's right. We, as part of our research, whenever we looked at a particular sexual interest, whether it was being interested in large women or being interested in stories about gay men, we always try to anchor our research. You know, our research was heavily data-driven, you know, massive data, and also looking at neuroscience, a lot of abstract sort of things. But we always try to anchor it by actually talking to people that had that interest and just sitting down and listening to them talk about it to make sure that their natural sort of explanations and natural discussion about it matched the kind of results we were getting, to sort of ground it. And yes, it's true. And for the lesbians, we just had a lot of trouble. I think the reason why is two heterosexual men, you know, trying to find out sexual details about lesbian preferences. And so there was just a wariness about it. And as a result, we just didn't get the kind of data that we felt comfortable with. So we gathered data and we analyzed it, but just we never felt the same level of comfort we did with other data. So we ended up not including that in the book. Hopefully in the future, we'll be able to remedy that. Since the book's come out, I have been contacted by a number of lesbian women that did, you know, want to share their experiences and said they'd be perfectly willing to help guide us into that material. So hopefully the opportunity to pursue that further will come up in the near future.
Well, I want to follow up on what you were saying about what you did find out about straight women, that they are particularly interested in stories more than kind
That's
of the,
right.
the visual cues that men go for. What kinds of stories?
So the single most popular erotic artifact for women in the world is the romance novel. And just about as many women buy romance novels as men look at online pornography. Those numbers are very similar. And romance novels have been around for a long time. About probably the first romance novel was a novel called Pamela from 1740, which is actually a pretty good model for novels even today. It was about a 15-year-old servant girl who's seduced by a wealthy, powerful baron. And so you see echoes of that even in 50 Shades of Grey, which is still popular today. And in the romance novels, there's always a very consistent pattern. There's a dominant, powerful male. The most common heroes in romance novels are always what are called alpha males. They're doctors or physicians or princes or kings or knights. You never find plumbers and you know, mid-level managers as the heroes in romance novels. And they're always strong, powerful males who have a secret soft side that the heroine, through the course of the story, has to help the man get in touch with and ultimately help the man admit that he is that he has tender romantic feelings for the woman. So
I saw you give a talk, and you described it as the coconut, the
That's
hard
right.
just shell on the outside, but you crack it open. And
That's right. That's,
there's
that's
the romantic mush for the, on the
for
inside.
For the romance novel, is the you got to tame the wild coconut. The romance hero is hard and tough on the outside and soft and gooey on the inside. And it's up, but it's only the heroine can access that soft, gooey interior. So that's part of the story. That's part of the romance. That's part of the female archetype of the romance. It's this unique woman. Only she has the power to crack open the man's coconut.
And you said one of the other things that I know you found about women is that one of the things that really turns them on is being desired.
Absolutely. So most of the cues that arouse men are external. It's looking outward, looking at the woman's body, hearing the woman speak. Male sexuality is not very internal. Men aren't very self-aware and self-focused when they're sexually aroused. Women have a mix. You know, women are certainly focused on the man, but they also are highly sensitive to their own feelings, everything from the temperature and if they're hungry or not, but especially how the man's making them feel inside. So the most prominent of these internal cues for women is the feeling of being desired. Very important for a woman to feel she's sexually desirable. And this comes out in the romance novels and in fan fiction as well, that when the heroine, there's usually places where the heroine is the center of attention, or the heroine is singled out among all the women that are there. You know, oftentimes romance heroines are kind of ordinary, and you know, on the surface they don't seem to be able to compete with all these other beautiful women that are around. But the hero makes her feel that she's the most beautiful. The hero acknowledges that she's got some special qualities that make her incredibly desirable. So that's always an essential part of the romance story as well.
You talk about the sexual desires of heterosexual women as the Miss Marple detective agency. Can you explain what you mean there?
Certainly. So another fundamental difference between the female sexual brain and the male sexual brain is that for the male sexual brain, it's aroused by any single cue, just the sight of a pair of attractive breasts, or you know, a younger woman or an older woman, you know, a heavy woman. Just the sight of one specific thing can be enough to turn a man on. But for the female brain, it requires more information. It requires multiple cues simultaneously or in succession. And the female brain is designed to constantly try to solicit more and more information. In the romance novels, part of the journey is the woman, the heroine, constantly acquiring more information about the man. It's sort of like a detective story in every romance novel, that she's trying to find out, you know, what happened in his past, who does he really like, you know, are his social claims, you know, valid, why does he get angry, whenever it's raining outside, you know, everything is viewed as a piece of, as a clue, as a mystery that must be solved to assemble a picture of the man. It's just the way the female brain is designed to work erotically. And you might ask, so, you know, why in the world is this? Again, this gets back to this notion that for a woman, an ideal man is ever-changing. It's context-dependent. It depends on the particular culture and environment when a woman finds herself. And so she needs to find out far more pieces of information that are not obvious, you know, that require some sleuthing. You know, is he kind or is he pretending to be kind? Is he wealthy or is he faking being wealthy? The female brain has to act like a detective to get answers to these questions before she's willing to commit, you know, before she's willing to have sex with the man and have, you know, risk having a kid with a guy that, you know, may or may not stick around. So that's why she needs to be a detective to determine a man's level of commitment and kindness and decency.
As I listen to you, I wonder how much of this is biological. How much of these sort of sexual patterns are sort of go back into our evolutionary history, and how much is shaped by culture? Because, you know, you think about the porn industry or the entertainment industry that trades on sexual and romantic fantasies. Is this culturally determined in some way?
So let me talk about that, because that's a very profound question and probably the most important question that we were trying to tackle with this broad body of research is, you know, how much are our sexual interests shaped by culture and how much are biological? I'd say the answer is mostly biological, but with some qualifications. So for men, it pretty much is biological. The visual things that they're interested in, they're consistent across cultures. I mentioned that in every single culture, China, Saudi Arabia, America, Mexico, men are interested, gay and straight men are interested in chests, butts, feet, and penises. Very, very consistent. It's hard to imagine how these four body parts can be so consistent unless there's a biological basis. And the other thing is that men's sexual interests seem to become fixated sometime in adolescence, roughly between the ages of 12 and 22, roughly, for a man. His sexual interests get fixed, and then they don't change for the rest of his life. So it seems like he's biologically designed to sort of look for certain visual cues. When he's an adolescent, these kind of get cemented in, kind of get hardened, and then they don't change much. Guys tend to search for the same kind of sexual material over and over again across their entire life. So women's a little bit different. Women are much more flexible and adaptive in their sexual interests. So women are, in fact, more open to cultural influences in what they find to be sexually arousing. What a woman's interested in at age 21 might be completely different than what she finds arousing at age 41. And there is good biological reason for that. For a woman, what makes an ideal partner is very context-dependent. You know, she needs a man that's going to be able to take care of her, to take care of her kids, to be committed to her. And what kind of man can fulfill that does change depending on the culture and age. You know, in some cultures, you need a really strong, physically powerful man to protect you. In modern societies, you need a man who's smart and wealthy and socially connected. So, you know, a woman needs to be able to adjust her idea of what a sexually ideal partner. But for a man, you know, what's a sexually ideal woman is a healthy, fertile body. That's it. That doesn't change from culture to culture or generation to generation. And that's probably why the things that arouse men, these specific body parts, are so consistent across cultures, because what you need to look for in an ideal woman just doesn't change.
What do you think people should do with these study results that you have found? I mean, you've mined literally millions of websites looking for, you know, all kinds of information. Because I would think the tendency might be for, let's say, me as a man, oh, this is what the vast majority of men want. Therefore, I guess that's what I should want, too, if I'm going to be a good, you know, red-blooded American male.
Well, I think first and foremost, as you said, I think what the contribution of our research is to help people understand themselves and make sense of their interests. A lot of people have sexual interests that they feel embarrassed about, ashamed about, that maybe even scares them. They don't know what to make of it, what it means. And our book allows people to see, you know, just how common some of these interests are. You know, a number of interests that you might not think are common turn out to be extremely common, just downright normal and natural. And so just being able to get some insight into what is, you know, common or not.
Well, and I mean, one of the things that comes out is a lot of behaviors or desires that would seem to be deviant in some circles are actually incredibly common.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, just take one example that surprised us is the interest in transsexual porn, often called shemale porn. You might think that's an unusual and deviant and rare interest. It turns out extremely popular among heterosexual men all around the world. And, you know, we know from hearing people talk after we came out with a book that, you know, people who are interested in looking at shemale porn, they feel a lot of shame and they think it's deviant. They think there's something wrong with it. They don't understand it. And, you know, our book can show and it explains why. This is probably very natural. It's just, it happens to be a quirk of the way the male sexual brain is wired that might explain why we find this so arousing. And at the very least, it's extremely common, and you shouldn't feel at all that you're unnatural. So that's one of the big contributions of all of this, is that we finally know, we can see, you know, what people are really interested in. Until we did this research, we just didn't know. We guessed, we hoped, we speculated, but we didn't know. But now we finally can know.
It's kind of astonishing to hear you say that we really didn't know what people wanted in sex. I mean, until the last few years. I mean, there have been, you know, well, centuries of people, you know, talking about this, hundreds of years of scientists trying to look at this.
It's downright astonishing. I mean, we all kind of took it for granted, and we didn't want to think about it. You know, it's let's say you were interested in something that might seem deviant. Of course, you're not going to talk about it, and you're not going to raise it. Hey, how common is this? You know, it's very embarrassing, and you feel very uncomfortable talking about it. So, not even scientists. You know, it's funny looking back on, you know, a lot of the research on sexuality over the past few decades. And, you know, when it comes down to it, it really wasn't based on anything. You know, people had no idea how common different paraphilias, different fetishes were. It was mostly speculation, or they'd have like a population. Most of the research that's done on the frequency of sexual interest is done in mental health patient populations in hospitals. You know, they'd look at 200 patients in a mental hospital and figure out their sexual interests. And that's where most of the data came from until we did this research. So, yeah, truly astonishing to go from almost no knowledge at all to now just overwhelming level of knowledge. So I don't think society's caught up yet and sex research has caught up yet. You know, it's such a shift that it's taking a little while to digest.
So what does all this sex research mean for romance? I mean, what's the role of sex in the biology of romance for men and women, straight or not?
Sexual desire seems to be the engine for romance. I mean, what's the biological function of romance? It's to create this irrational basis for a long-term relationship and sexual reproduction. I say irrational because when you're swept away in the throes of romance, you don't think logically anymore. You know, you're designed not to think logically anymore. You think the person's, you know, fantastic and perfect and one of a kind, and that you're going to be with them forever, and you'll do anything for them. All that's designed to promote, you know, long-term bonding with someone and to facilitate sexual production. And so, because of that, what sexual desires drives this? You know, we fall most in love. We fall most in romantic love with individuals that meet some of our sexual ideals. If you look at the kinds of people that when people talk about the first time they fell in love or the stories of the greatest loves of their life, it's almost inevitably the person does meet their sexual ideal or is close to their sexual ideal when they have stories like this. And it's no coincidence. So certainly romance is much more than just the sexual attraction. But unless you have powerful sexual attraction, usually the romance doesn't really take wing.
Well, this is all quite fascinating. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.